pilot.
Pilot? What's a pilot?
Well, the way they pick TV shows is they make one show. That show's called a pilot. They show that one show to the people who pick shows, and on the strength of that one show, they decide if they want to make more shows. Some get chosen and become television programs. Some don't, become nothing. She starred in one of the ones that became nothing.
When you watch television, Keith, do you prefer something that is a little more of an escape, a departure from reality, or do you lean more towards something that's a little more real, something with a little more grit and is more of a reflection on the world that we live in?
Depends on my mood. Because there are times when I really need like a good fantasy or sci-fi show. And then if I would probably gravitate towards the genre escapism, but if you give me a good show with some good characters, like I would say The Wire or The Bear, give me that gritty rawness, realism.
Yeah, you know, when realism is done well, it can be really compelling, but I think it's good to have a mix of both, right? If you have too many shows that are just reminding you of the world you already live in, then maybe you sort of lose the entertainment factor, right? It's good to sometimes have something to take you away from, you know, from our current reality and, you know, take us away to something more imaginative. But I bring this up because the show we're talking about today definitely lives in that world of realism. And that show is Saint Elsewhere. So we're continuing with our doctor's note genre of the medical dramas, or just the medical genre. Some of them are funny, but this one definitely is a drama. And we're jumping ahead. Last week we talked about MASH, which first aired in 1972. And now with Saint Elsewhere, we're jumping to 1982. Interesting era for entertainment, the early 80s. It still has that late 70s vibe to it, right?
But oh, very much so. It almost like it's like that Serpico French Connection, like almost like documentary style.
Yeah, there's definitely a like the look of it, right? It still has a raw sort of feel, but at the same time it does have the touch of the 80s with the music and
the hair.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Big hair. So yeah, the early 80s, very interesting time. And you know, with this show and its theme of realism and its groundedness, I think that was a departure for a lot of other shows. Watching this and seeing all the different ensemble characters, all these interwoven stories, it made me think, wow, is this show like really setting a precedent for all the other shows that we've discussed that have similar ambitions when it comes to the writing and the directing? Because, you know, 1982, you know, with the exception of the production value, it seems very ahead of its time.
Or maybe it's like both of its time and ahead of its time, because I was thinking about this and my mom was a huge fan of Saint Elsewhere. And I asked her, I'm like, was there any other show like this at the time or before that? Of course, you had like, MASH is more of a sitcom that is about like doctors at war, and you had medical shows, but I would say like in that early 80s, late 70s, early 80s, you had like Saint Elsewhere present a new style of medical show. Like I think they started utilizing flashbacks and dream sequences, and like we talked about that grittiness, Hill Street Blues with the cop drama. And also you had shows like Dallas kind of really step it up for primetime soap operas, like Who Shot JR, that shook the nation. Like TV was,
oh, for sure.
TV was just taking stepping up a notch.
Yeah,
in terms of quality,
the stakes were starting to get higher, for sure. Because for the longest time, the stakes of TV were not quite at the same level as film. But it's funny you mentioned Hill Street Blues, because that was produced by the same production house as seen elsewhere, MTM Enterprises. So this is sort of their bread and butter, right? Something a little more innovative, something that was touching on a lot of current events, a lot of current issues, and giving you like a real snapshot of the time. And so I think for that reason too, from what I understand, this show did a lot better with younger viewers than it did with older viewers, because this is just a theory of mine, but I always was under the impression that younger generations typically want more authenticity in their storytelling. And maybe as you get older, you kind of lean a little more towards something a little more familiar and comforting. But certainly with this show, I think there's some experimenting also with the direction and the styles, right? They're trying all different kinds of things. And I think for an older viewer, you just want to stick to what you know. And for younger viewers, you want to see what is new. You want to see people trying to push the boundary of what TV storytelling can do.
It's fresh. Like it's something so authentic and fresh, and you know, I think raw. I might even cut that. Like it's something that people haven't seen before on television. And I was thinking as I was watching this pilot, and if I were to continue it, I would imagine I would see plot lines, like I could see where the story is going and going like, oh, how quaint. But I have to remember, like, this show is the top of the pyramid, and then it inspired shows like ER, all the House, all these other medical shows were influenced by this. And at the time, these are fresh stories.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the idea of having such a huge ensemble cast, because, you know, that hospitals have such a large staff of all these different doctors who have conflicting viewpoints and conflicting agendas, and also to show how, you know, a doctor's personal life is affecting their career and then vice versa. You know, it really humanizes the medical profession in a way that maybe for some people is a little unnerving, right? You don't want to think of your doctor as a vulnerable person who might make a mistake or might have something else on their mind when they're treating you, but they're human just like we are. So I think it's better to see the human element in that profession and to see those stories, because I think it gives you a better appreciation for especially these kinds of characters who are trying to make a difference in their patients' lives.
No, I'm sure a lot of doctors like really appreciated seeing like I'm sure they made sure they got the details right. Like even in the first episode, the jargon, how they're talking to each other. It's like, if you just misstep it, it kind of just loses something. And someone, granted, there was no internet back then, but someone could be like, all right, they're just saying words, but you know, they have to get the dosages, the medicine, the protocol, procedures. Like it just feels real.
Right. That goes into the authenticity of it. And that's a big challenge with the medical genre in general, is having that research. I imagine that a lot of these shows might have advisors or consultants working with the writing team to get those fine details down. And maybe even you have former doctors who become writers, right? Like to have a knack for both storytelling and the knowledge of this profession. You know, it takes you know, a big team to get that all together, but also to juggle also many different stories. So watching this pilot, I had a little difficulty at first keeping track of all these characters and remembering what their names were. It is a lot of people. Even watching the opening credits, it's like, oh, okay. Like they're listing off like 10 names here, and those are just the lead or the lead characters. You have so many people, and so that adds to the, you know, it feels so lived in this hospital, but it's jarring and a challenge when you're first introduced as a viewer for the first time.
I always think, because we're a podcast about pilots, you know, it's a first date. It's kind of confusing. And, you know, maybe by the third, fourth, fifth episode of any ensemble cast, if it was that way with Game of Thrones with me, I'm sure Sopranos had that to some effect. You start to know the characters more. You start to at least like pay attention to who's who and who you care about more. And speaking of ensemble cast, like what a cast. Like I knew some people came from this show. I didn't know everybody famous came from this show.
There are a lot of recognizable faces in this, which was really cool to see. I mean, just from the get-go, I think the biggest star to come from this had to have been Denzel Washington, who was, I think, 28 years old when this pilot aired, so very young, just getting started, and obviously go on to become a huge movie star. But then you also have Howie Mandel in this with a full head of hair.
That was the shock for me.
Yeah, almost unrecognizable for people who follow him now.
Well, he was a stand-up comedian. I always knew him as the comedian who was famous for putting a balloon on his head and just blowing it up with his nose. I didn't realize a door opened for him and he went in it. Like, he stayed for all six seasons.
That's correct. And my impression of him in this is sort of part comic relief, but also maybe the more immature doctor who's a little more self-aware. I don't know. I think they play into his comedic background, but it does fit for this drama. It's like an unlikely match that I think works. And then you also have William Daniels, who most millennials would recognize as Mr. Feeny from Boy Meets World. In this, he plays a surgeon who maybe has not the best, not the best tolerance for doctors from other countries, as we come to discover.
But he's one of the top surgeons there.
Well, yes. But yeah, it's such a contrast. You're used to seeing him as this teacher, this very benign character from Boy Meets World. And then in this, he's a much harder character, much more headstrong and intolerant too. He's very smart. He's very talented, but it's again of its time. And I guess this was maybe around the time where you saw more of an influx of doctors and medical professionals coming in from other countries. So I think they were just touching on that because at the time, William Daniels, he was in his mid-50s.
He is 97 right now. I looked it up because just a little fun fact, his wife on the show was actually his wife in real life.
Oh, and okay.
They've been married. They're both still alive. He's 97. Quite an achievement. They've been married for 73 years.
Wow.
That's 1951. And that is when they tell you at a wedding, how many of you have been married for 5 years? And everyone claps, 73 years. Good for him. And for someone to have a career from he was Dustin Hoffman's dad in the grass. He's been famous for every generation. Every generation can just he is this part to me. Maybe not Gen Z, but you can always go back and go, he's Mr. Feeny. He's, Mark Craig, he's The Graduate, Plastics. And he was also the SAG president at one point. I remember that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so definitely a...
And this is where he won the Emmys.
This show was definitely a critical darling and won many awards. And that's the other thing, too. It wasn't just very popular among younger viewers. Critics loved it. But it just wasn't the strongest rated show. Thankfully, it was good enough to go on for six seasons. But that tends to happen with shows that are trying to do something new. It's not going to be as appealing in a broad sense, but it had a very loyal following, right? I think the numbers were consistent throughout all 6 years, which is good. I mean, at the very least, if you're not the top rated show, you at least want a dedicated following.
My mom was dedicated. She made sure she would watch at 10 o'clock NBC every Tuesday, and I think she said it moved to Wednesdays, but she loved this show.
I can see why people fell in love with this. I think it's a very sincere show, very heartfelt, and I was just thinking too a second ago, you mentioned how there's such a big cast, and we were saying, it's similar to other shows that have a huge ensemble. But at least in this day and age, we have the benefit of streaming and being able to rewatch on a whim or rewind as we're watching it. I watched this twice, right? As we normally do, we watch these pilots a couple times. And the second time, it made way more sense to me, and I could see what was being set up. But, in 1982, you watch it once. They do have reruns sometimes. But, for the most part, you just got to learn as you go. And if you miss something, then hopefully you can catch up. But it was just not as easy, right? Everything was just live viewing, appointment viewing. So, a bigger challenge to get familiar with these characters back in 1982 than it would be now. But I don't know. We'll see. I'll spoil this and say that I'm kind of tempted to continue with this show, at least watch a few more episodes, because I don't know, there's something that struck with me, the show. There's like that genuine, like, empathy that is being conveyed in this. Okay. I was really digging it.
I will put this on the back burner for now. I think this is the same, like, as you know, the studiers of television. I would like to watch this show at one point. There's a lot on my plate at the moment. But I will say that anyone who loves the medical genre, like I know people who love Grey's Anatomy. If you like that show, The Good Doctor or ER or House, like this is the like kind of see where it all began because it's good.
Yeah, like, no, it's
like if
it's,
you need something to watch, I think people can get a lot out of this.
Even beyond the medical genre, I think just the approach with the storytelling here is at a level of ambition that I think is equal to a lot of the shows we've praised so much already, like an HBO series. You know, it's there's a real dedication to not just the visual storytelling, the structure, the chronology of it. You know, it's very thoughtful in a way that I was very impressed, because you know, I wasn't aware that a show could be so ambitious back in 1982.
Yeah, no, it's like it broke new ground.
yeah, for sure. And we just have a briefer pilot history for this show. So this, Keith, if you want to take us through it was harder to find more information about this show, but we were able to find some things about how this came to be. So Keith, take us through that.
So this aired on October 26, 1982. It was a Tuesday. And it was hard. I don't think people had rating systems back then.
I don't know if there were like episodic ratings. There were rankings, and
it was like 47. It never really, like you said, it had its own like dedicated fan base. But it was created by Joshua Brann and John Falsley, and those two met as writers on the CBS drama The White Shadow. Now Joshua Brann would go on to create another hit show in the 90s called Northern Exposure, and at least for us, JJ, he ended up being a writer on The Americans.
Oh, right on. That's one of our favorite shows. Yeah. So, you know, if you want to really have a show that is about very solid, strong writing, this guy is a veteran that can definitely get a writer's room together and, you know, someone to look to create a really comprehensive story.
It was directed by Thomas Carter, who would later go on to direct movies like Save the Last Dance and Coach Carter. But yeah, the series, like you said, was produced by MTM, and you know, I think their brand at the time was just these gritty realism dramas with ensemble casts.
All right, so yeah, like I said, not the most in-depth pilot history, but you know, I think this is a show that a lot of what's said about it is its impact afterwards. So certainly at the end of this pilot, we'll be discussing the legacy of this show and. I do want to bring up its very iconic ending, which is a bit of a thinker. So we'll get to that. But first, Keith, let's take us to the pilot.
Flight 527, runway 8 kilo, you're cleared for takeoff.
All right. So right away, we start with the intro credits with a great theme by Dave Grusin. You know, you get the this St. Eligius in Boston, Massachusetts, like this, you know, it's kind of a, I don't want to say worn down, but it's an underfunded kind of hospital.
It looks old, you know.
It looks old. But you start to get the cast and you're like, oh, wow. Oh, wow. There's a lot of people in this.
Oh yeah, so many people, like we mentioned before, but you know, that's why, like, as we go through this, I'll keep referring to like the IMDb lists of, you know, each character, because it's I think I have the hang of it by now, but just in case, I'll keep it handy.
I have the main ones, although I told you before the podcast, I have a little doctor actor cheat sheet right next to me just to make sure I get the names right. But yeah, we open up and each act is, or a lot of the scenes are broken up by the time, which I don't know if they do that in any other episode, but it very much works for the pilot. Because this is a day in the life kind of pilot, and we've had that kind of pilot before, but I think, yeah, you're about to really be introduced in the world of St. Allegius.
Yeah, I think the timestamps, I think, especially make sense for the character we're following most in this first episode, and the fact that I feel like the character at the main center here is only listed as like. In the second round, like not the main actor, but like, you know, the also starring group, it gives me a sense that maybe each episode focuses on a different character. You know, did you get a sense of that?
Yeah. I didn't think he was like JD from Scrubs, although there were some similarities. It was hard not to like compare, but I figured like, you know, by the way, the actor that we're talking about is Dave Morse, who,
oh,
we've
yes.
Seen also, we've seen in like Green Mile, Disturbia.
I should have mentioned Dave Morse too, because I really like that actor as well.
He's so young. He usually plays like an adult man and stuff, but here I bet he's like a 28-year-old something with hair.
29 years old, with like really like big curly hair. I actually also know this guy from being in a really interesting Stephen King TV movie called The Langoliers.
He was in that? Oh my god, yeah,
he's one of the few bright spots in that, but just a very familiar face. Has been a lots of stuff.
You know, it's 9:30 p.m. and Luther Hawkins is one of the guys, is just, I think he, an orderly, he's just, you know, kind of moseying around the main hall, and you know, it's kind of slow, but he's walking the halls and he's kind of checking the payphones for any loose change. And this is right away, we're introduced to David Morse's character, Dr. Jack Morrison, who's right in the middle of a 48-hour shift.
Yeah, I see. That, I think, is the reason for the timestamps. We're going to be following Dr. Jack Morrison. That's the character played by David Morse. And we're really going to, you know, be reminded of how long this shift is, right? He's already 24 hours in, and he has a whole nother day to go. So this is like the rest of that shift for him. So that's brutal. 48 hours. I was aware doctors have long shifts. I've never heard of a 48-hour one, but I believe it.
I think, because he's a first year, like you get the sense that he's just like, he is thrown into the trenches of this.
He's at the bottom of the ladder, right?
And looks like one of his colleagues that he's friendly with is Dr. Annie. Canavero. And you know, Jack is talking about one patient that he has, a Sandy Mallon, who is this little girl who's just sick. Like, she's throwing up, she hasn't been able to keep food down. It's just like, you know, he's kind of really grown attached to her in a way, like, you know, she's my patient, I'm trying to figure out what's wrong with her. And you know, Dr. Annie passes off another, like an older patient onto him, like just kind of making his day or like shift even more.
Yeah, because she's like, I'm intolerable. She's like, I'm leaving. Goodbye. But since you're stuck here, here's one of my patients that now you have to look after, right? She's kind of like, she's like, you know, I remember when I was a first year resident, you know, like it's a rite of passage that this guy is going through. And, you know, other doctors, it's like you have to do that in order to earn your stripes.
Yeah, she said the first year is always the toughest. But yeah, you know, Jack seems to be he still has like 24 hours left to go. So we're like smack dab in the middle of it. And another actor who we've all seen before, Ed Begley Jr., he's playing Dr. Victor Ehrlich. And he's in a nice suit. He seems to be like, okay, this is my good friend. It looks like they started out together.
Yeah, they're from the same class of first year residents. I whenever I see this actor though, in this show, I'm thinking of Stan Sitwell from Arrested Development. So interesting to see him with eyebrows.
Yeah, he's mostly like all those Christopher Guest movies. He's mainly a comic actor, and in it, I'm getting the sense that he's like the best friend nerd, but we get a little bits of him, of his personality in this pilot, but not a lot. But right away, he's in a suit. His aunt's in town, and she just wants to take him out to dinner. But after his shift, he just wants to go to sleep, and he's like, "How do I tell my aunt I want to sleep with her?" As Jack Morrison escorts his friend to the elevator, Victor reminds him not to miss rounds. He really pissed off, or he really irked Dr. Donald Westfall, who's kind of like the head doctor at that place. And, he has to try. He just has to do better. And Jack, meanwhile, he's like, "I haven't even seen my wife." Like, he just seems like he is in over his head or just overwhelmed.
Overextended, I think, is another good point. Because now he also has to cover another doctor, right? There's a Dr. Peter White who's called out. And now Jack has to cover for him. So, it's we're going to see this guy get very much at the end of his ropes. And already at the very beginning, it does seem overwhelming for him.
So Jack goes to check in on his patient, Sandy Mallon, who's like this 15-year-old teenage girl. And, he gives her ice chips, and it just, they're trying to figure out what's wrong with her, but he's waiting to hear back from test results and all that. But he kind of assures her, he comforts her, he tells her it's going to be okay.
Yeah. They have like a rapport already, which is nice. They kind of seem to get each other a little bit.
And as Jack is having coffee, he's called in for an emergency, like, "Hey, you, we need you right away." And a patient has stopped breathing. And this is where, even though it's a day in the life, at a hospital, even though they're implementing CPR, as hard as you try, someone's going to die, or people are going to die at this hospital.
Yeah, right away, we get this guy, he's in a wheelchair, and he's not breathing, and all these doctors and nurses are trying to revive him, and they're—I don't want to say they're blasé about it, but they're just maybe a little cavalier, because this is just what they're used to, right? You're in a hospital, and these sort of things are going to happen.
I think that's going to be a if we were to connect some of the shows that we're watching, the older, more seasoned doctors are kind of just there as mentors, and just like, "Hey, this is part of the life." And you got I'm thinking JD from Scrubs. I'm thinking Jack, who is just idealistic. And of course it's good to be idealistic and give everything your best, but they will quickly realize that they can't save everybody and things are not going to go their way.
Yeah. I think that's a recurring theme for a lot of these shows, is young doctors maybe getting a little too emotionally attached to their patients, and having to find the right balance, right? You want good bedside manners, you want to be invested in your patient, but not to the point where either clouds your judgment or you're unable to move on after you're done treating them.
So the next scene, we're a couple hours have gone by. It's 7:11 a.m. and Dr. Donald Westfall, who I thought the actor's name was Ned Flanders. It's actually Ed Flanders.
Close enough.
But he's, doing rounds with his first year residents. And doing rounds is, I didn't really have a thing on the turn. I didn't know that was a thing. But you kind of go around and you either go take the patient that the doctors are covering or just another patient, and you kind of figure out what's wrong with him. It's kind of a pop quiz almost, or something like that.
Yeah, from my impression is all these doctors are walking around, these first year residents are walking around with this experienced doctor. Maybe he's the head of this resident program, and everyone's kind of summarizing their cases. They're all learning from each other, right? I looked it up. This St. Eligius is a learning hospital, so this is a chance for everyone to just learn more on the job. And obviously Jack missing this is crucial, right? It's very detrimental to his experience and his learning to not be a part of this.
But the ensemble grows a little bit more. We're introduced to Dr. Philip Chandler, played by Denzel Washington. We get Wayne Fiscus, Howie Mandel's character, but we get Wendy Armstrong. And we also see Victor, or everyone is just kind of, kind of following Westfall, and they're talking about their patients. And then we, you know, Jack rushes because he was taking care of Peter White's patient, and you know, it's noticed by Westfall, but it does, it's not brought up.
He gets the "nice of you to join us" line.
Yeah, you get from, right? Yeah, you get that
classic like know, classic teacher line when you're late to class, right? Nice of you to join
us. Yeah, you kind of know you're in trouble. You're like, oh crap! It's like he's you know, he's doing everything at the moment,
right?
But he is allowed to talk, you know, talk about his patient with, and it seems like Sandy was on a class trip in South America and drank some of the water, which would, of course, dysentery would be the diagnosis, but they just want to do a liver scan to rule out an abscess. Like one of the other main characters, Dr. Ben Samuels, walks through, excuse me, and Fiscus is the first one to kind of alert everyone, like he gets around, he yeah. has VD.
You know
which
what?
Which is, I was shocked for like not only a pilot, but like an NBC pilot. Like, oh yeah, this guy has a venereal disease.
Right, right. And you know what's funny about that too? I think that in the soap opera version of these medical shows, that's kind of a archetype, is the doctor who sleeps with all the nurses. But that's not too far removed from reality, I don't think, at least for the time. My parents had worked in a hospital, and I think they told me that, yeah, that there were like some notable doctors there who, you know, like you said, got around. And that is going to cause some problems, though, in this for the staff, and especially in this day and age.
I would imagine just like the stress and just the need to like put off stress if you're single. It just, and you're, you know, you have something to like, you're both in the same situation. I could see that, but this, it looks like Ben Samuels gets around.
Right, right.
That will be his arc for this episode, basically.
Right, right, right. I mean, he's like the big doctor there. I get a sense that he's like a lead surgeon. He's very experienced and he spends a lot of time around these nurses. So I'm sure he has his way of charming a lot of these staff members.
Now, one conversation that I did find important, because we haven't been introduced to William Daniels' character, Mark Craig, yet, but Victor and Dr. Wendy are kind of talking in the back of the group, and Victor asks about the new clocks. And we find out that they were donated by one of Dr. Craig's like patients in a gratitude, and you kind of figure out like, okay, this Dr. Craig, he cares about the hospital, but he's like a top notch surgeon.
Yeah, and he has a reputation for just being a hard ass, right? Like he's very respected and very good at what he does, but you don't want to get on his bad side.
So Wayne introduces himself to a doctor from pathology, Dr. Kathy Martin, and you know, you're already getting a sense. There's a nice like flirtation, like, oh, hello.
A little like meet cute.
Like we kind of know each other. Like we, you know, we have someone in common, like someone's liver.
Yeah, it's an interesting way to meet someone or to pick someone up, right? It's like, oh, like we worked on the same patient.
It's so weird that this guy would go on to do like
Deal or No Deal.
deal or No Deal, America's Got Talent.
I know, I know. It's yeah, this is just an earlier part of his career, but I'm sure if like reverse, you know, people who saw him in this and then saw him go on to like game shows and stuff, that's equally as jarring as a transition.
So 9 a.m. rolls in, and so does Dr. Arthur, who this is a unique shot, like for at least I've never seen it in an 82 show. Like we get his POV. And, you know, it doesn't, you know, it's someone strolling through the hallways listening to the police. De-do-do-do.
It's a de-do-do-do, da-da-da-da. And you know what? This is what I was going back to in terms of the experimentation on this show, right? This is like a very out of style shot, this POV shot, as this guy is walking to the hospital. At first, I didn't even know it was a POV shot. I'm like, wait, there's like a soundtrack all of a sudden to this show. And it's not, I don't know if you think it's like the actual police. I think it's like a band to sound like the police. I think that has to do with like,
oh, really?
Copyright. Yeah. Cause I've listened to that, the album that the song is on. I'm like, wait a minute, that sounds a little off.
Oh, okay.
But I do like the song selection. da-do-do-do-da-da-da, that's all I have to say to you. Because
it's all I have to say to you.
Exactly, because in that next scene after this, we're hearing all the doctors discussing their patients and using all these like medical terms, technical terms, and for a lot of their patients and a lot of the viewers at home who are not medical professionals, that's all, it's kind of what it sounds like, to do-do-do, right? It just, it's like, okay, like we're trying to keep up here, but we're not quite understanding every single word they're saying.
But yeah, we, it's another chance to expand the ensemble in just small, unique ways. Like, you know, we meet Nurse Helen, Nurse Helen Rosenthal, played by Christina Pickles. And we would know her from, she played Ross and Ross and Monica's mom.
Oh, right. Mrs. What was her last name on that show?
Geller.
Mrs. Geller. Christina Pickles. I never heard of that as a last name except for the Rugrats. But yeah, we meet her. I thought there was like a quick joke snuck into this scene too, as we're hearing all these doctors talking about their patients, or maybe just talking of like teaching each other tips about like what to do. At one point, we hear someone like talking about like a recipe, like cooking, and it's like it sounds like they're talking about something medical, and then it turns out they're just talking about like an egg recipe or something.
Well, the humor is coming from Dr. Samuels, who's talking to a nurse about like, "Hey, are you all right? Like, are you experiencing anything weird, any discharge?" And she's like, "What? Like, what are you talking? What do you mean?" And you're like, well, that's his day today. That's yes. What he has to do.
A little degrading, but necessary for him.
We are now finally introduced to Dr. Mark Craig as he bursts into Donald's office. And he's mad. He's mad that he's complaining about an Indian anesthesiologist he has to work with. And you know, he's like, I'm not trying to be racist. It's just like, what? Like, there's just a smell coming from him.
Yes, his words. And
oh, yeah, his words.
Right. And, you know, it's an interesting first impression for this character, is him not being the most tolerant person. But, you know, again, he's like an old school guy. He's an older doctor. So, yeah, he might have some outdated attitudes.
And this Indian doctor, Vijay Koshar, he would be on the show, like he would become he's part of the ensemble as well, or would become a major character.
Yeah.
So I'm sure I'd be interested to see where that plot line goes, because they're in that close proximity to each other.
Yeah. Maybe like there's a learning opportunity there for Dr. Mark Craig.
Yeah. Jack is with Sandy again, and he just got his, he's going to get her liver exam. And in this whole conversation, like you said, the conversation feels like a brother and sister almost.
Yeah, you know, it's very friendly, and they are just, you know, it's kind of sweet. They have like a very benign friendship here. But yeah, Jack, as the doctor, has to be careful, right? Like he cares about her, and he has very good bedside manners. But, you know, it's he can't get too invested in just one patient.
And that, I think, is what we're seeing in, like, hindsight. Like, it's just like, oh, I see where the conflict really comes. Because you don't know – I didn't notice – or I didn't pick up on it really right away. But knowing at first I just saw the scene as just, like, an innocent conversation. But, yeah, no, there is just, like, wow, he will do anything to get her better, which is admirable, as you should as a doctor. But – I think what this show also does is throws in the bureaucracy,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure. It's like there are sometimes things that are be out of his hands, but I do think that yeah, Jack, he's making like the right decisions to get to the bottom of, you know, what's causing Sandy's illness here. Like he does like have a good instinct for this kind of thing, right? Like he is a good doctor. I think that's my first impression of him.
Now, Donald, Philip, and Wendy are walking down in the stairwell, and they pass a Dr. Auschlinger. And it's like, oh, how you doing today, Daniel? And, you know, he's like, yeah, you know, is the elevator broken? He's like, no, I just want the steps. And you find out that Dr. Auschlinger has liver cancer, which is kind of ironic because he's a doctor of the liver. Now, they're worried about him. Like, shouldn't, like, but Dr. Westfall says, like, don't worry, he'll outlive us all, which I found so interesting.
Yeah, interesting comment to make. I mean, what do you think that ties into? Like, what are you picking up with that comment?
Well, I think Donald Westfall is saying that to his first year, Philip and Wendy, and they're just like, they don't know him like Donald does. It seems like Donald and Daniel have a very close relationship. They've been at Allegis for years, and yeah, no, it's just, I know this guy's grit, but in terms of it, in a meta fun fact, Dr. Auschlinger is played by Norman Lloyd, and he was only supposed to be on St. Elsewhere for 4 episodes, but they decided, they enjoyed working with him, and they decided to keep him for throughout the series.
I love when that happens, right? Like, you see potential in a character that as you were writing them, you didn't think about, but maybe through the performance, through the actor, you see more potential. So yeah, I love when that happens.
But with this character, you're able to explore like just a cancer diagnosis. But I just also, I was like, where have I seen this actor before? And if you ever watch through the bloopers of Trainwreck, he is one of the actors in the nursing home. And he makes a point to say that he's 100 at the point that they're filming. But he actually died at the age of 106. So in some ways, he did outlive a good amount of people.
Wow. That is very impressive.
Hats off to him.
Oh, absolutely. And from what I understand, too, this character plays an interesting role in the ending of the show as well. So just another hint there.
The finale, like ending?
Yes, yes.
Oh, wow. So Luther, who we saw in the beginning, he manages to find Dr. Cavanero, and he's like, oh, like, get your patient, Henry Smith, under control. This guy is a monster. He is a nutcase. And, you know, he informs her, like, he missed physical therapy. And if it happens again, like, I'm not doing, like, he's out. And that's when she goes to check on her patient, and, you know, there's just a guy reading a newspaper, and it turns out, and it's not Henry. And she's like, where's Henry Smith? And the guy's like, I don't know. So her patient is missing.
Yes, that's going to be her story now. Annie Canavaro is going to be tracking down this patient. And I think her story in this first episode is going to highlight the dysfunction of the hospital. Sort of like, you know, how things slip through the cracks. Because, yeah, it is an older hospital. We're going to be reminded that, yeah, you know, it's... there are a lot of really talented doctors here, but as a facility, you know, it's seen better days.
No, it understands why this place gets its name or its nickname.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah, that's we'll touch on that later on with the reputation of the hospital.
I told the nurse to call me if you need me. I'll be here all night.
My mouth is so dry.
I know. I'm sorry. I'm afraid to give you any more water until I know what's wrong with you. I've scheduled a liver scan for tomorrow morning.
And that will finally tell you what's wrong with me, because I can't take any more of this throwing up.
I know. I hope tomorrow we'll know for sure.
We come back at 12:24 p.m., and all the first-year residents, all that group is having lunch at the moment. They're all kind of eating. Fiskett seems to be in the middle of telling a story of reviving a patient. And this is where he's just like, I think Howie Mandel gets to be a little bit of his Howie Mandel. It's kind of like, it's one of those funny stories.
Yeah, that's what I was getting a sense of, is like, of the different personality types in this group, he's going to be maybe the one who tells these funny stories and exaggerates and has a funny comment about this and that. He'll tease the other characters, right? So, you know, it is a drama, this show, but you would have characters like this who maybe make light of certain situations, even if it's as a defense mechanism.
It looks to be a show that, like, does have heavy moments, but it's not heavy all the time.
Right. There are some even, like, subtly funny moments, like, you know, amusing moments, even in this first episode.
So, at another point, like Mark walks over to his Indian colleague and he kind of quizzes him kind of off, like in the moment, like, what does this have to do? And the guy's like, wait, what? I'm sorry. It's like, he kind of scoffs. It's like, oh, amateur. I'm dealing with amateurs here.
Yeah, but that's so unfair, right? Like you randomly out of the blue, like test somebody about their medical knowledge and they're like, wait, what are you saying? And doesn't really give him a chance to answer the question fairly.
No, it's like, I guess when you don't like someone, you're just going to find every reason to not work with them or like them.
That's exactly it, yeah.
So this is where, you know, in walks in Peter White, and this is where Jack gets a chance to like confront. He's like, hey, what happened, man? Like, why am I covering for you? And it turns out that Peter White's son or kid is sick. And it's like, you know, I was about to ready to lay into this guy, and then he throws that at me. And it's like, oh, I get it. But you could clearly see that Jack is on edge. Like, he is like on a thin, like, but he did the best thing at the moment. He's like, how is he? How's your son?
Yeah, yeah. Like, he, you know, Jack, again, he's very frustrated, understandably. Peter feels bad that he had to have this other doctor cover for him. And it's like an interesting moment when Peter says, you know, well, my kid was sick. What was I supposed to do? And Jack says, well, yeah, I don't know. It's this shared moment of almost futility, right? It's like, okay, we're all just doing our best here. And, you know, sometimes we're going to be in a lose-lose situation. So it's like there's a moment of appreciation from Peter, but also guilt. And Jack just has to move on. You know, he can't waste his energy, what little he has, beating up on a guy who was in a tough spot.
But he does get a pager and he leaves. It looks like he got some results in. And Dr. Canavero arrives and, you know, it seems like they all know about this missing patient. This is fun gossip for them. And, you know, everyone's kind of teasing her. Wayne and Ben are like, ha, like, you know, they're making their jokes. But Victor chimes in and is like, hey, I just left Henry Smith at radiology. Oh, my God. And this is where, like, you know, she rushes to radiology and you see just like a little boy in a wheelchair.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm thinking, like, was
very
that
common name?
Right, right. I was like, was that a joke or that it just happens to be another Henry Smith? I also got a kick out of the guy working in radiology, right? And he goes into radiology and there's a guy with a newspaper and she's like, excuse me, like, I'm sorry to bother you. Like, you had this guy who clearly is kind of checked out, right? Like, maybe not as invested in,
not the best section of the hospital,
right? Like,
I
would
imagine.
Whatever he has to do, whatever this guy's job is, he's very despondent.
But that just goes once again, like, that little humor. It's like, oh, all my prayers are about to be answered, and womp womp,
wrong Henry Smith.
But Jack goes to visit Sandy with the results from her liver scan, and unfortunately, she does have an abscess on her liver. But he is going to just want to do a biopsy on her, and he needs her parents' permission. And that's like it seems like Sandy knows her mom, and her mom is the last thing she wants to deal with right now.
Yeah, you know, if anything, Sandy seems more concerned about her mother's involvement than she is about her sickness, right? Like, I think she feels very comfortable with Jack, that he's going to be able to fix what's wrong with her. And yeah, Jack does a good job too of easing her worries about what the biopsy is, right? Like, oh, is this going to leave a scar? No, don't worry. It's just like a needle injection. So that speaks to how good of a doctor he is in their relationship, that, you know, she gets this news about an abscess, but she's not worried about that. She knows she's in good hands.
Dr. Samuels is, you know, his mission takes him to nurse
Shirley Daniels,
and, you know, he kind of pulls her aside in private, and he's nervous, and he's like, I got gonorrhea. And she's just looking at him going like, oh, okay. And, you know, he's like, you should get it checked out. And I did have a laugh at the scene. It's like, oh yeah, they didn't have sex. They just went to the movies and he fell asleep halfway through.
Yeah, like, he can't even remember who he slept with and who he hasn't slept with yet, right? Like, I thought that was funny. And, you know, like, he first of all, I think this name Shirley Daniels is, like, such a name of that time, right? Like, it's, like, a very, like, 70s, 80s kind of name, Shirley. But yeah, like he tells someone that he didn't have to, right? It's a very embarrassing thing to have to tell somebody, and it wasn't even necessary. And I thought it was funny too. He's like, okay, well, when this clears up and when my gonorrhea clears up, maybe I can give you another call. And she's like, yeah, sure. I thought that was funny. Like, he's still like trying to salvage a romantic opportunity here.
I'm very curious where this character can go. Like, what is this character's many arcs? Like, I'm just like, cause you know, right now it's kind of like, I'm not saying it's not needed for the pilot. It does add a lot of fun and levity, but like, where, I'm just kind of curious what other layers are to this character.
Right. Well, he's not a first year resident, right? This Ben Samuels guy, he is more of an experienced doctor here. And he's listed in that higher tier of starring
actors. Second, I think, right?
Right.
I think he was number two.
After Ed Flanders. Exactly. So yeah, it seems like he's going to play at least a major part in the story initially. I did kind of spoil for myself in looking up the cast list here and seeing the list of main characters per season. So I'm sort of aware of the longevity of certain characters. So, you know, if I do continue with this, I might be aware of that going forward, like with this character or another. But yeah, I think at least in the first season, there's probably something already in mind for him.
Well, it's always curious to know the how it happens rather than
exactly
that. But you know, he's on his quest to tell everybody about his situation, or tell the people that he's been involved with about his situation. Meanwhile, Dr. Cavaniero's on her quest to find her missing patient. So she goes, since this guy is from a mental institution, she goes to the psych ward, and where we're introduced kind of like, even though he's part of the cast, this is his only scene where we're introduced to Dr. Hugh Beale. And he kind of has this funny moment because all he sees is shrimp in the Rorschach test, but he's no help to her. He hasn't seen anything.
Right. Yeah. It is a brief moment for this character who, like you said, is in the main cast, but that's the thing with an ensemble. I bet you in every episode, there's going to be at least one cast member who only has one scene. This actor, G.W. Bailey, I looked up, and he did have a role in MASH, actually, but I think past the pilot we would have recognized him. And I think one of the first titles that popped up is that he was a regular in the Police Academy films. So someone who would have been recognized by mainstream audiences by that time.
So it's now 2:56, and Dr. Jack finds himself arguing with the surgeon. And this guy wants to do a surgery on Sandy to remove the abscess. Meanwhile, Dr. Jack is like, no, I just want to stick with the biopsy. A surgery could make things worse. What if she has a parasite?
Yeah, no, he makes a good point, right? Dr. Westfall has to kind of mediate this argument too, you know?
It gets bad. Like, they're shouting in front of everybody. Like, quiet. And, you know, it's like he decides to side for now with Jack. Just wait until the liver biopsy comes back, and then we'll see what we do going forward.
Yeah, you know, this surgeon, I'm curious if he comes back as a character, or if he continues to be maybe like an obstacle for Jack or one of the other main cast members, because he's like, you know, this is routine to just remove an abscess. And Jack brings up a good point about, you know, if it's amoebic, that could make it, you know, it could cause more problems to do surgery. And the guy still says he doesn't see the point of doing the biopsy, right? He's just very gung-ho about doing the procedure. And Jack even says, oh, surgeons, they just want to cut, cut, cut. And I find that interesting, too, when with any of these medical genre shows is getting, like, the attitudes that certain departments have about each other. You know, like, Jack is the guy who doesn't seem to have a positive view on surgeons. So that's interesting to me.
No, the doctors and the surgeons can't be friends. It's like the it's like Oklahoma.
What is it, like the Jets and the Sharks?
It's like the Farmers and the Cowboys.
But
basically,
even beyond like surgeons, like I know some of the other shows we're going to discuss, like depending on if you're a pediatrician or if you're like, you know, specific departments in hospitals have certain reputations. And so that the politics of these institutions, I think, is a big appeal for viewers at home who might not be familiar if they're not part of that world.
The politics and the characters' philosophies.
Yeah, the different...
Like their philosophies of just how they approach. And
yeah.
Because it is, like, you would think to do surgery. Of course, remove the abscess. It's like, it's not that this doctor's necessarily wrong. Like, that's his way of coming at the problem. But Jack is kind of able to lay out a very good reason why surgery, you know, because, you know, parasites could lay dormant because she was in South America. Like, let's just wait on it for just a quick sec. She'll be fine.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So you're right. The approach, right? Because as someone who would just be a patient in the medical system, I just trust that if a doctor wants to go a certain route, that must be the best way to go. It's like, oh, you know, there's sometimes different strategies here. And hopefully you have someone who's the most level-minded person, you know, deciding on what to do.
And right before Jack leaves, you know, Westfall kind of chides him for being late to rounds and kind of just says, like, be better.
Right. Well, he even tells Jack, you know, like, because he understands Jack was covering for someone. So Westfall tells Jack, you know, you can't cover for your friends. You know, like, I understand you want to do a favor for them, but you have to look out for yourself. So that's interesting. You know, Jack, he's putting a lot of people before himself and not just his patient. So not to say that he's like a pushover, but he just seems to be someone who wants to always do what's right for other people and maybe not always for himself.
He really is, like, you know, even through this conversation, he is kind of just learning how to swim again. Like, yeah. You know, it's just because it does look like he's drowning, like it, or like he just feels like he's drowning. And right now, like, that's, even though that's really good advice, that's probably not what he wants to hear right now. It just, like, because it just feels like I feel like I'm doing something right, but you're telling me that's all you see is the wrong.
Right. And, you know, I think that's also a commentary on just the system, right? These are very, like, overly worked, overtaxed people who are just trying to do the best they can. You know, you always get it. I also get a sense that with St. Eligius, it's not just sort of a rundown hospital, but also, you know, short on resources. That includes staff members. So, yeah, you're going to have times where, you're not having enough people to cover all the bases there. And so that's, Jack has to reconcile with that reality.
Were you really in South America, Dr. Morrison?
Actually, it was Mexico. I was in medical school there for 2 years.
Why'd you go there?
I had lousy grades in college.
Did you speak Spanish?
Not a word. I had to buy 2 sets of textbooks. After 2 years, I came back, finished up here.
So, do you like being a doctor?
I don't know yet. Talk to me when I'm awake.
All right, so we come back from an act break, and it's 3:15. And we arrive right in the middle of Dr. Westfall in the middle of negotiating an order for new scrubs. He's trying to get, like, 300 for a good price.
Yeah, you know, he has a funny comment, too, about, like, Boston General, they can get their scrubs at Filene's, but not us. You know, like, it's another way to establish that they are at a lower budget. You know, they have to make do with what they can.
But even though it's brief, it does add to the authenticity. Like, I'm sure, like, I'm not saying, like, when has no one's ever seen someone ordering scrubs on TV before, but it's just a little short scene that just makes it more real. Like, yeah.
Especially
part of the life.
Especially to have this doctor having to do this. I would think in the bigger and better finance hospital, you have an administrator taking care of all this. So that's the other thing too, with the lack of resources. You have doctors having to do non-doctor things, right? And that just takes up a lot of their valuable time.
Maybe at this hospital.
For St. Eligius, right? At Boston General, I'm sure they have, you know, plenty of people to take care of these things.
So Helen comes in and she kind of tells Dr. Westfall that, you know, many of the patients and staff are worried about Henry Smith's absence and, you know, kind of, and Dr. Westfall is just kind of like, yeah, okay. He's kind of like nonchalant, like, okay, this is just another problem. Like, it's Tuesday.
This has probably happened before, right? Yeah. Patient going missing.
Yeah, he's very nonchalant about it. He's like, all right, just I need to see Dr. Caravero. So we go back to Jack, who's visiting Sandy, and he's happy with the results. And she will not need surgery. And she'll be out in a couple weeks. And this is a great scene, but it adds to the point of, like, he's getting too attached, because she starts to ask him, like, how did he get his medical license? And, you know, he didn't do that well in school, but he did do 2 years at medical school in Mexico. That's how he's able to connect with her on a South American Mexico level. He's like, oh, I've been outside of America, he says earlier in the episode.
You know what, too,
I just didn't drink the water.
The other thing, too, is him saying he spent his first 2 years of med school in Mexico. I have heard of this before, of people going outside the country to do their education for medicine just because it's cheaper. And then they, you know, either they finish up, or, you know, they get their practical experience done in the States. But not that uncommon. Again, kind of just speaks to just how the system is, that, you know, a lot of these doctors, when they're getting started, like, obviously when you go up the ladder, you'll start making a lot more money. But when you're just starting out, you know, you have to do what you can. And sometimes that means, going an alternate route for your education.
She does ask him, innocuous question, but it's just like, do you like being a doctor? And that to me is, I think, the theme of this pilot. It's just like,
yeah,
it's a tough question to answer, really.
The golden question, right? Because I think he is thinking about that at least a few times during this first episode. She also asks him, like, are you married? And he's like, what does he say? He's like, come on, you're only 15.
Yeah. Yeah, like, okay, like, this is where I do think it's still like the brother sister, like, it's like, but, you know, she put a lot of trust in him. But we do get that little piece that Jack is married.
Yes. So, yeah, a little backstory here on his medical training, on that he's married. You know, it's a good way to show not just he's getting close with this patient, but we as an audience are now learning more about his history, too. And again, that's a tough thing for a doctor. You want to connect with your patient, but to open up so much about yourself now, you're kind of getting into tricky territory here.
So Donald and Canavero are chatting about Henry Smith, and he's kind of like, hey, you should have told you, like, everybody knows except for security. Like, you should tell security. But we also see, like, a side of Annie that, like, she is kind of like Jack, that she really does care about her patients. But I think it's also like, I think when you're given a patient, you just kind of, you know, their life is in your hands. Doesn't matter, rich, poor, black, white, whatever.
This is such a great scene. We get this speech here from Annie about just how this patient, Henry Smith, is another person who's fallen through the cracks. And he's someone that a lot of people don't think about, that he doesn't have anybody. And so she really feels a responsibility for this patient, maybe more so than the average patient that at least she sees has other people in their lives. And so, you know, maybe she's not personally attached in the sense that she's gotten to know this patient, but in the sense that, you know, she might have seen similar kinds of patients that don't have anybody to look out for them. So I like the compassion from this character, and also like the show's kind of commentary too about, you know, how sometimes people, they go through the system, and they wind up with nobody and nothing. And, you know, sometimes it takes just one person, like a doctor, to advocate for them.
Well said. And it looks like Westfall is just filled with that kind of just seasoned advice. He's just like, you can't handle everything.
Yeah, exactly. He's very benign. You know, I think he is empathetic to what these younger doctors are struggling with.
He had to be there. Like, he had to be in their shoes before.
Yeah, no, exactly. He's seen it all. And but at the same time, you know, I think he's very good at countering their idealism with, like, you know, just the facts. You know, he's not cold about it. Like, you know, he's very understanding and sympathetic to what they're going through. But, you know, it's like, I don't know, it maybe shows his bedside manner, right? Like, he has just the right dose of truth for these doctors.
So something's afoot right now. Something's just happened. Dr. Samuels rushes in and we see a really badly damaged woman. And it turns out there's a bombing went off in a bank. And, you know, unfortunately, she's one of the victims. And they actually are also treating the terrorist on another floor. It's just like, I would think it's kind of shocking to me how, like, in my head, I'm like, this should be bigger, but this is not the focus of the episode.
Yeah.
But in any other show that we've seen or modern day, this would be the terrorist bombing at a bank, 911, ER. And I'm not saying that's a bad, it's just a part of their day.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of like emotional whiplash because we go from this scene with Dr. Westfall and Dr. Andy Canavaro, and then we go into this like very dramatic scene with kind of scary synthesizer music, and it's a rush, right? Like there's all this to do as they're getting this patient into the ER, and that's where Fiskus and Dr. Ben Samuels, I guess they're like ER and operating room doctors, so they're going to be working on this patient, but it really is just a very small slice of this pilot. I suspect that this storyline with the terrorist will continue in the upcoming episodes. Interesting that.
Let me know.
Yeah, right.
Let me know. I'm very curious.
We'll see.
I even in the episode, it's like it's kind of they're not talking about the attack. They're just kind of talking about like the after effects of the attack, and not even from a medical standpoint. But we'll get to that in just a sec. But first, Jack's been called now to Dr. Westfall's office, and he's in the middle of a conversation with Sandy's mom, who is very nice. She compliments Jack. He's like, I can see why my daughter really, like, she said so much nice things about you. But the reason why she's there is she wants to transfer Sandy to another hospital.
Yeah, that Boston General. The
Boston General, yeah.
Yeah, that may be like a better equipped and better financed hospital. So, yeah, that's a tough thing to deal with, right? And I like, too, that Sandy's mom, she is nice, right? It's not like sometimes in some other shows you get these unreasonable parents of child patients who are – they're going in there on a mission and they can't be reasoned with. But yeah, she's like, it's all very understandable situation, right? Like there's no bad actors in this.
No, it seems like for her, she's just like, oh, I wasn't even aware that my daughter was on a field trip and now she's in the hospital. So like, yeah, you can feel it. But on one hand, as nice as she is, Jack is gutted. Like he is pleading with her, like, please do not move her. She is safe here and she's going to get better here. But Donald Westfall steps in and just like, we're going to move her tomorrow. Thank you for your stay. And it's really like, why? Another lesson, Jack, like the parents have the final say.
No, it's another tough lesson to learn. And yeah, Dr. Westfall, he's very good at facilitating this whole conversation here. But yeah, it's nothing personal, right? And for Jack, he does take it personally, but he has to learn not to. And that's such a hard thing. It's just being part of being young and being like a young adult. It's so much easier to take really anything personally, even if it is in a professional context. So
amp that up to 11 when you're a doctor and you're kind of responsible for someone's life.
Right.
Like they're literally in your hands.
Much higher stakes. Right. Exactly.
Yeah. But kind of a break from, I guess, any of the action, we get Fiskus sees Kathy in the stairwell and she's in the middle of reading. It seems like she's on break, just away from it all. And I always say there's some like he's still flirting with her, but it's a little off. Like he tries to ask her out and she's on call, but they agree to meet later.
Yeah, it's like a little awkward. It kind of feels like maybe like a scene out of high school or something, like running into the girl you like in the stairwell. But this Kathy character, the next scene we'll see her, she kind of unnerves me a little bit.
It's all in the eyes. It's all in the eyes.
Totally
baby.
Agree. Yeah. But we'll see when we get there.
You know, Donald, you can be a very negative thinking person. Do you know what people call this place? Not St. Allegius, St. Elsewhere. A dumping ground, a place you wouldn't want to send your mother-in-law. And now, somebody around here is trying to garner a little goodwill publicity and possibly raise a few bucks for this rat hole, and all I'm getting is problems.
Now, Ma.
No, I mean it.
So we come back from an act break, and it may not have been the police, but that was we definitely hear Bruce Springsteen playing as Victor, Vijay, Samuels. They're all in the middle of operating on these injured terrorist victims. And yeah, no, it's even during all this, Victor apparently went out with Denise, and that allows Samuel to have like this little funny moment. It's like, oh, because you went out with Denise, I think we have to talk.
Yeah. It turns out, I guess they went out with the same nurse, and there's this sort of comical shot of Victor kind of letting that sink in, like, uh-oh, like he's putting two and two together in that moment, and it's unfortunate for him.
Annie's still looking for Henry Smith, and luckily Jack's nearby, and, you know, we finally have a connection. He knows where Henry is. And as it turns out, the guy who passed away in the very beginning of the show, of the episode, he was Henry Smith, who Jack tried to give CPR to.
Right. And but there's a thing here. Like, why hasn't Annie heard about this yet?
Because Jack forgot to turn in the death certificate. And it seems like an easy mistake, especially with the kind of day Jack's had. But no, she's angry. She's angry.
Oh, she's furious. And Jack feels so terrible. I think the second he realizes his mistake, you see his face drop as he just slowly pulls out the death certificate from his pocket. Like, I have it here. And yeah, she kind of hits him, right? Like, he has to kind of hold her arm from
like,
hitting him.
Does like the two hand, like, how dare you kind of.
And this is really a very compelling intersection of their two stories, right? Because you had Annie in a prior scene going on about how this poor guy, he's fallen through the cracks, right? And this is just very enigmatic of that, right? Like, his own death hadn't been recorded yet. That's how much this guy has been forgotten about. And meanwhile, with Jack, this is the culmination of his mental, emotional, and physical exhaustion. So this, I think, is a real testament to the writers being able to dovetail these two character stories here. So very, very impressed by how they managed to tie those two storylines together.
That's a great observation. I just realized, with Annie, it was just like everything she felt about this guy just coming out at once. And understandable, cathartic, but they'll be talking again soon. Meanwhile, Dr. Auschlinger, Craig, and Donald, they have this big opportunity on their hands. They have the terrorists of the bombing in their hospital. They're trying to see if they could get any publicity out of it.
Yeah, right. I mean, it seems like Donald Westphal, he's maybe like a little hesitant about this press conference.
Yeah, can we
idea?
Just get an ad agency or something?
Yeah, this is where we get. So Dr. Mark Craig here is going to give us the title of the show in this rant where, he explains the title of the hospital, the nickname of the hospital.
They call the place St. Elsewhere because it's basically used as a dumping ground. Like you probably want to send your patients somewhere else, but this is where the losers get treated in a way.
Which is so interesting to me because it's not like maybe they're short staffed and short resourced, but the doctors there are good doctors. You maybe saw a couple of characters here and there in the episode so far who seemed like a little removed in going through the motions, but I think for the most part, like, it's even like Dr. Mark Craig, for his shortcomings we've seen so far, like, he's a reputable surgeon. Like, he's someone that you would want to have in charge of your operation. So that I found to be an interesting contrast. It's not as if this hospital is repelling talent. People do want to work there.
not only is he very crafted at his skill, but he cares. He wants to make the place better. He, like, there's a reason he got the new clocks, like, and they're all saying the same time.
Oh, right. The previously the clocks are all were all a little bit off, which is an interesting detail to a place that is kind of in shambles, right? That's, and in a hospital, you need everyone to be aligned on the time.
But he cares very much, and he's willing. He's like, if other hospitals can get the benefit of having, like, murderers at, like, I think he brings up Boston General again, if they could get the publicity and donations from having a murderer in their care, why can't we use this terrorist? And I think that does manage, or he manages to convince Westfall to join him in the press conference. And the same thing with Dr. Auschinger. All three of these men seem to have started together. They've been in the trenches. So they do, even though they may differ, they respect each other and they like each other.
Yeah, the respect definitely is going to be there. I just am a little confused how this will generate donations to the hospital for them to have a press conference about how they are treating a terrorist, right? Like, I'm just not seeing how you get from one step to the other. Like, okay, it's very high profile patient because he's a terrorist, but how is that going to inspire funding for the hospital? I'm not sure.
I think it's just, it seems like they got everybody, the terrorists and the victims, and if anything, just use the terrorists as, like, notoriety,
I guess. I guess just to get the name of the hospital more out there, but yeah, it seemed like not a very intuitive strategy.
But if it worked for Boston General, like, it just, I think it, like, nothing, there's no bad idea, or there's no bad any bad publicity's good publicity's at this point.
That's fair. Yeah, that's what they say.
So Jack visits Sandy again, and she doesn't want to leave. She knew her mom would do this, and she doesn't want to go. She's kind of angry at her mom, and Jack makes a very mature decision, and he tells her, like, your mom's doing it for all the right reasons. And he loves her, and he manages to convince her to go.
Yeah, well, yeah. At first, too, she's, like, a little hurt by him, too. Like, oh, so you're just going to kick me out of here? Is that it? Right? Like, you know, there is kind of a feeling of rejection. But, you know, Jack's like, listen, I've done all I can for you. And, you know, there's just, like, a moment where, you know, he's like, not saying in so many words, but it's not as if their friendship will be totally forgotten or for nothing. You know, like, he's subtle about it. And, you know, I understand where she's coming from, too. You know, like, she's, like, an impressionable young teenager. And so, yeah, it's easy to feel like, oh, like, you know, all that friendship we were building, are you just going to toss that away?
Yeah, she's hurt. But he does make a good comment at the end. He's like, hey, I promise I'll see you before you leave. And it's now 8:04, and Jack is trying, he's using the payphone to try to call his wife, and it just seems like, you know, just a misconnection, like, just, she's not there, and he's trying to leave a message, and it seems like this isn't the first time this happened.
Right, because at this time, it's 8:04 p.m., right? So this is, like, towards the end of his 48-hour shift, I think, but yeah, it's, I mean, 8:04, you know, it's not, like, super late, but, you know, at nighttime, it's not as easy to reach people.
And then we get to a very interesting scene where Fiscus and Kathy are meeting up, and they appear to be in the morgue. Like that, or I understood it to be the morgue.
Very romantic and, setting.
You know, he asks her how she got into pathology, and it seems like she worked with somebody and fell in love, and he died, and she made a vow to never work with people anymore. And you're thinking, okay, I get that. Give Fiscus something to work for. And then she goes, would you like to kiss me?
Yeah, and but she's saying it like, she has this look in her eye that's like a little devious, or I don't know. I was a little scared of this Kathy character, especially the fact that, you know, she's making moves on Wayne and they're surrounded by dead bodies.
She does a sexy pose on the on like the
Slab.
The slab. It's just so like, and they're like making out with dead bodies everywhere.
I know. It's very strange. It's a little surreal. And, you know, Fisk is, you know, Howie Mandel, he has a kind of a funny moment here where he's a little hesitant and he sort of like does the old like pulling on the collar. But he's like, he has like a comment to himself, like, all right, I don't know what I'm getting into here, but screw it. And so, you know, I'd be interested in seeing if he goes on to regret starting a relationship with this girl, right? Given that she seems to have sort of a, a little bit of an off edge. Streak. Yeah, a little bit of an edge.
I was going to say, if you decide to purchase this ticket and take the flight for the show, let me know. Like, it's still the early 80s, but I'm very curious if, like, there is, like, an actions have consequences, or if it's, I know it's, like, how episode of the week is it, but how, like, I'm very curious to see how the show develops or what it turns into.
I'm very curious to see how the focus shifts from character to character, right? Is each episode going to have the one or two characters at the forefront? Are they going to have more episodes where there's an equal distribution of screen time? I'm not quite sure, but I'll definitely look out for that. And yeah, I'll let you know. Either way, I'm impressed enough to, my interest is piqued.
Annie comes to check in on Jack. She wants to apologize for how she acted. And yeah, Jack's had it. He's worn down. He just wants his privacy. He wants to see his wife. This is David Morris's big monologue. This is the show's big monologue. Just like, you really get to see just how, the life of a doctor or a new doctor, it could be just a lot. It just could be a lot of heartbreak and just
this to me is
a day with no wins.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's like he's been beaten down, and this is like, you know, if the phrase "end of your rope" has never been more true than it is for this character.
Yeah,
yeah, he's just emotionally drained, and in this monologue, it's like he's completely letting go of everything he's been holding back up to that point, right? And so Annie is very understanding. I get a sense from this actress that in her eyes, it's like she's been there. Like, she's recognizing Jack is in a state that she's been in plenty of times before, especially in those early years.
Well, she throws her hand out to him and he kind of like he accepts it.
Yeah. Yeah, but I just, you know, my heart goes out to this character because there's just like a desperation there. It's like he doesn't know what to do at this point. And it's like, you know, should he be continuing with this or not? Right. He seems like he's lost in this moment without a clear resolution as to how to, you know, come out of this funk. And so, you know, that's a tough thing to leave off with this character.
Well, as Sandy asked him, do you like being a doctor?
TBD.
And she meant it so innocently, but it's, at this moment, it's to be determined. So it's 10:47. It's time to wrap things up. Donald Westfall is getting ready, and his secretary, Irma, says goodbye to him, tells him to find a new wife.
Yeah, you know, she's a little insensitive about that, though, because when Dr. Westfall said, oh, I had a wife and she passed away, Irma is like so matter of fact about it. She's like, well, when your wife dies, just get a new one. It's like, okay, Irma.
Yeah, I wonder how long she's been. She has to be there long to have that kind of relationship with her boss.
Yeah, I know. But she's so dry about that delivery. I thought that was kind of funny. But at the same time, I'm like, you know what, Irma? I don't think I want to talk to you about this anymore.
And he's walking out and he happens to pass by Sandy's room. She's asleep and he looks over and Jack's asleep on the chair beside the bed, and he gives a smile as he walks out, and it's the kind of smile that, like, I know this guy's a good doctor and he will learn, like, I've been there too kind of stuff. Like, I understand.
It's like a bittersweet smile. It's like he's like, you know, he sees the good in Jack, but also he feels sad for him too.
It's going to take a while to, like, for him to really figure out, like the inner workings of being a doctor.
Yeah. And, you know, as this scene is playing out, as Dr. Westfall was leaving his office, walking down the hallway, sees Jack, you hear the theme song slowly creeping up again, but a sort of like a slower, more meditative version of it. It just made me feel very nice inside. Like, oh, like, you know, I think this show is in good hands. It's a very humanistic show with moments of bitter sweetness, but I think a little more sweet than bitter.
And he wants something for nausea, or his pain isn't quite in control, or whatever it is, it starts wearing on you. It's like, leave me alone. Why can't I have my privacy? Why can't I eat my meal in peace? Why must I always be available? Constantly.
I'm sure you'll get ahead of me on this, but I definitely would like to visit this show, just even as a student of television.
Well, you know, if we were our age in 1982 and we see this, I think I would be continuing to watch. Yeah. Or I would catch the next episode the following week and probably continue on from there. And, you know, the other appealing thing, too, as we alluded to before, was just, you know, just how innovative this show feels also on a technical level. You know, you had that POV shot, which was surprising. And I think as, you know, a younger audience, that sort of thing gets you excited. You know, it seems like this show has almost like an unpredictability about it, right? Like you never know what they have up their sleeve next. And that's, you know, that's something to shake up the landscape.
Yeah, no, like it was like one of the first shows to really use like flashbacks and dream sequences, and at least for a drama. Like, I think that's like it. I'm kind of curious to see what chances it took.
Yeah. No.
Storytelling wise.
Absolutely. And the set here, the St. Eligius Hospital set, I do like this because it's very unique looking. It doesn't look like a typical hospital because of how old it is. It almost seems like it used to be something else. It almost seems like this hospital might have been like an old public school or something, and then it was retrofitted to be a hospital or something. Like, I don't know if you got the same sense, but it just seemed like, you know, it had so much character to it.
Yeah, it was like a brick-layered hospital. Yeah, so like one of the dorms, one of the old school dorms that we had at Rutgers.
Yeah.
Like from the 17th century, 18th, not one of the modern ones.
Absolutely. It definitely seems like it's gone through a few different uses, this building, St. Eligius Hospital. So that kind of adds to the feeling of this being like an older rundown hospital. It doesn't seem like it's totally in shambles, but it, you know, it's like they're making do with what they have.
Being in a modern hospital, you're like, I'm in the future. So yeah, it just seems like a throwback, and it fits the what the show's trying to at least say, or at least like the kind of issues that St. Elsewhere is dealing with, like just at least budget wise, just seems like it's always one step forward, two steps back kind of hospital.
Yeah, it seems like it's always going to be a struggle for them to be able to accomplish the things they want, maybe keep up with certain medical innovations, right? And they're always going to be in the shadow of these bigger and shinier hospitals. But, you know, that's maybe not a place that a lot of viewers want to spend their time, right? I think that is speaking to maybe why this isn't as broadly appealing, because it does feel so gritty. I think sometimes, you know, people want the more soap opera general hospital feel, where it is maybe more about the drama and it feels like a little more safe, right? It seems like this hospital, it's not like the typical safe feeling hospital, right? It seems like a vulnerable place, which I like, but it's not for everybody.
Okay, I've never really watched other medical shows, so it's going to be interesting to compare and contrast.
You know what would be fun?
Like the modern day medical drama goes about it.
You know, what if we like just keep in mind all these different hospitals and doctors as we go through our doctor's note, and maybe just at the end of this series, just maybe say, like, you know, which doctor we'd want to see, which hospital would you want to check into, right? I feel like I would want to maybe see some of these doctors, maybe not stay at this exact hospital, but, you know, there's more to a hospital, though, than shiny gadgets, right? I think there's even a line that, you know, Dr. Morris has that Jack says about, oh, a lot of people feel that bigger and newer is better, but that's not necessarily true. Yeah, we'll see with these bigger and shinier hospitals if they are better or not, because we certainly have a lot of them that we'll be visiting. So definitely rave reviews, at least from me, I think from you too, Keith, for St. Elsewhere. Definitely a landmark. Oh, and I did mention too, I just want to touch up, this does have one of the most innovative and like contemplative finales of all time.
I love it. It branched like one of the best theories of television ever.
Right, right. What do they call it? Like the Tommy Westfall universe?
The Tommy Westfall universe theory.
Right. So, you know, this show ended over 30 years ago. So I think it's safe to maybe spoil the ending a little bit, which is in the very last scene, we see a much younger Dr. Donald Westfall and his autistic son who has a snow globe with the St. Allegis like model inside the snow globe. And like we, in this final scene, Westfall is not even a doctor. And I think we also see the actor who plays, Auschlander as his father. And so we're led to believe that the whole show was in the imagination of Westfall's autistic son. And that is wild, right? To maybe suggest
that's an insane, but it's reminiscent, I think, because I'd be curious to see if it fits the tone of the show, even as in crazy as it is. It's reminiscent of the Bob Newhart, or at
right,
least like,
yeah, like it was all a dream, right?
His second sitcom, he woke up next to his first sitcom's wife, and I don't know, it's memorable.
It certainly is. And I think, too, it's just something to challenge the viewer, because if someone were to say, well, then what was the whole point if it didn't really happen? Well, it didn't really happen either way, because it was written by people. It's not, you know, it's not a documentary. So whether it's from the whether the events of the show are from the imagination of this autistic child that we see, or from the imagination of the writers, you know, what difference does that make? Was the story interesting? Right. Of course, it didn't happen. It's fiction. So what difference does it make if it's, you know, a fictional story within a larger fictional framework? You know, I think it's just an interesting thing for audiences to see and challenge them as to how they view fiction. Because sometimes, you know, like when I was younger, like a kid, you know, I would watch something and think it was, you know, like you think it's actually happening when you're watching it. And then afterwards, you remember it's just a movie or a TV show. But maybe it's just something to keep in mind a little more consistently, like what you're seeing is fiction, but that doesn't mean that it's not relevant to your daily life.
Now, the theory is, and I'll just cover this quickly, is St. Elsewhere was just a big staple of the 80s, and like it crossed over with so many shows, like the, you know, characters appeared in the Cheers bar, like Craig and Auschlinger.
Right, because and both shows took place in Boston.
Hill Street Blues, of course, like, and because Hill Street Blues went to spawn off, like, you know, we got Munch, we got, you know, Law and Order, and Munch appeared in The Wire, Arrested Development, Sesame Street.
X-Files.
It's just that these, all TV is connected. And I think the Tommy Westfall, braver men have connected it more than me, but they've connected about like 400 something shows just based on like spinoffs and crossovers, like X-Files crossover crossover with The Simpsons. Like it just really kind of connects all of TV, but it's also a fun theory that it all takes place in this kid's head.
Well, again, these are all fictional shows. So what difference does it make if it takes place in one kid's head? Because either way, it didn't really happen. So you could imagine it any way you want to. And so that's like a fun thing to connect all these different dots, especially with that character Munch, who we know from Law & Order SVU. And he was also in a homicide, right? And yeah, he's a character who's appeared in a lot of things. So you can kind of like, you know, again, everything is within 6 degrees of separation, both from, you know, within these fictional universes and from the business side of it. So yeah, that's a fun exercise. But again, I think that finale moment is just, just something to leave audiences to chew on in terms of what fiction truly means.
And that was probably so unheard of outside of like a sitcom setting.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
That was probably so unheard of for a television show to end like that.
It's very daring, right? And I'm glad they made that chance. And I think it's so ahead of its time, because a lot of times when you hear about some of the most innovative finales, you think of stuff that came a little later on. But I would like to think that the writers of this show taking a chance on their finale maybe inspired so many writers afterwards to have just as daring of an ending.
Sopranos.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so we're going to be leaving St. Eligius for now, and we're going to be continuing down our tour of these other hospital shows, these other medical shows. And, you know, we've been mentioning ER a lot, and that is exactly where we're headed next, to the ER. And we'll catch you there at the next pilot. Follow us on Instagram and X, formerly Twitter, at Take Us to the Pilot. That's Take Us to the Pilot with the number 2.
Attention passengers, we've now reached our destination. We hope you enjoyed the flight and have a nice day.